Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of news and features presented throughout this past week on our VOA Asia program. This weekend,
based on the recent statement of North Korea, I have decided to terminate the planned summit in Singapore on June 12th.
We will explore that decision. Also today, the U.S. and China decide to reduce the pressures surrounding trade talks between the two, and someone other than you and your bank could be watching when you go to the ATM. That and much more on VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Thursday was to have been the day the world media focused on North Korea's controlled demolition, allegedly, of its nuclear testing facility. But that news was rapidly eclipsed by U.S. President Donald Trump's surprise announcement that he was canceling the much-anticipated June summit in Singapore between himself and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. So surprising, in fact, that not even South Korean officials had any heads up on the announcement. Mr. Trump made his wishes known in a letter to Kim, here read in its entirety before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
Dear Mr. Chairman, we greatly appreciate your time, patience, and effort with respect to our recent negotiations and discussions relative to a summit long sought by both parties, which was scheduled to take place on June 12th in Singapore. We are informed that the meeting was requested by North Korea, but that to us is totally irrelevant. I was very much looking forward to being there with you. Sadly, based on the tremendous anger and open hostility displayed in your most recent statement, I feel it is inappropriate at this time to have this long-planned meeting. Therefore, please let this letter serve to represent that the Singapore summit, for the good of both parties, but to the detriment of the world, will not take place. You talk about your nuclear capabilities, but ours are so massive and powerful that I pray to God they will never have to be used. I felt that a wonderful dialogue was building up between you and me, and ultimately is only that dialogue that matters. Someday, I look very much forward to meeting you. In the meantime, I want to thank you for the release of the hostages who are now home with their families. That was a beautiful gesture and was very much appreciated. If you change your mind having to do with this important summit, please do not hesitate to call me or write. The world, and North Korea in particular, has lost a great opportunity for lasting peace and great prosperity and wealth. This missed opportunity is a truly sad moment in history. Sincerely yours, Donald J. Trump, President of the United States of America.
Shortly later, Mr. Trump, speaking from the White House, blamed the summit's cancellation on recent official North Korean statements critical of Vice President Mike Pence and indirectly on influence from Chinese President Xi Jinping. And yet, while announcing the summit was off, Mr. Trump suggested it could still happen at some point.
A lot of things can happen, including the fact that perhaps, and would wait, it's possible that the existing summit could take place or a summit at some later date. Nobody should be anxious. We have to get it right.
From the outset, the U.S.-North Korean summit presented more questions than answers. What was its ultimate purpose? Why was it happening so fast? How would it be judged? Still, news of the summit's postponement is being welcomed in some quarters. Evans Revere is a director with the Albright-Stonebridge Group and has participated in numerous dialogues with both North and South Korea. He told me that Trump's cancellation may actually be good news.
Well, I must say, to be very frank with you, I was relieved, especially that it is happening now rather than to have it happen at the summit, and the it being the recognition by the president and his administration that the North Koreans are not serious, or at least not serious at this point, about denuclearization.
Do you think there was a turning point here? Why do you think that this happened now? Is it the given idea about the harsh rhetoric over the past week or so?
I read the president's letter carefully, I would hope that the United States government and the president in particular are not reacting to a letter or to a pair of messages, rather, from two senior foreign ministry officials, the first vice minister for foreign affairs, and then just a few hours ago, the vice minister, both of whom I know quite well. I hope they didn't react to their statements as being statements from the lips or from the pen of Kim Jong-un, because they are not necessarily that. They're authoritative, they're official, but they don't necessarily reflect all of the thinking of the North Korean leadership. So there may have been something else communicated by the North Koreans in recent days through the channels that have been established that made it pretty clear that the North Koreans were either having cold feet or were prepared to come to the negotiating table and say and do things that were not acceptable to the United States.
What do you think it was?
It's hard to say, but I note with great interest that just a few hours ago, as I was waking up early this morning, I saw an interview carried on the CNN website with an unnamed senior administration official. And I have to paraphrase it. I don't have his exact or her exact words in front of me right now. But that senior U.S. administration official made it very clear that there was no agreement on the part of the North Korean leader to denuclearize, that Secretary Pompeo in his two visits and others in their visits and in the ongoing communications between Washington and Pyongyang had not received a firm commitment by the North Korean leader to denuclearize. The way that this official put it is that we are waiting to see if the North Korean leader will make a commitment to denuclearize. We are going to try to maintain our contacts and continue to stay in touch at high levels. And this was, by the way, before the president's letter was released and his decision was released. But the import of this statement was that the U.S. government to this date has not received a firm commitment from North Korea to denuclearize.
Evans Revere with the Albright Stonebridge Group, who has participated in numerous dialogues with both North and South Korea. We are happy you are with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. Beijing has weathered only slight protest and light protest against its reported missile installations in the Spratly Islands, making it easier to strengthen its military outpost in the disputed South China Sea. That, according to analysts, Vietnam demanded on May 8th that China remove any missiles, but push no further. A presidential spokesman in the Philippines said it has active mechanisms to discuss militarization of the South China Sea, but does not see Beijing as a threat. Both countries, along with Brunei, Malaysia, and Taiwan, claim waters where China reportedly deployed anti-ship and surface-to-air missiles in April. More from VOA's Martin Seacrest.
Vietnam demanded May 8th that China remove any missiles but did not push further. And according to a presidential office spokesman, the Philippines has active mechanisms to discuss militarization of the South China Sea but does not see Beijing as a threat. Both countries, along with Brunei, Malaysia, and Taiwan, claim waters where China reportedly deployed anti-ship and surface-to-air missiles in April. The lack of further protest gives China a clear channel to keep any missiles in place on the three Spratly Islets where it has built installations over the past 2 years and added more weapon systems. China said last week it was testing bombers. Sean King, vice president of the Park Strategies political consultancy in New York, says it may be too late to raise objections.
The fizzling of regional protests against Beijing's installation of missiles in the South China Sea means Beijing's hegemony over said vast body of water is now a virtual fait accompli. There's not much left that anyone can do about it.
Beijing claims about 90% of the South China Sea overlapping waters that the five other governments say belongs to them. China has irked the others since 2010 by landfilling tiny islets, in some cases for military installations. Colin Koh is a maritime security research fellow at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. He sees China continuing its actions regardless of the reaction from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations unless it crosses the threshold of hostility.
I think China is more than willing to keep doing what it's doing, I mean, including those build-ups.
Analysts say China may be building up weapons to deter the United States and its powerful allies outside Southeast Asia from challenging its claim. Martin Seacrest, VOA News.
The United States has disinvited China from a major international maritime exercise, saying Beijing's destabilizing behavior in the South China Sea is inconsistent with the principles of the U.S.-led drill. A statement from the Pentagon read China's continued militarization of disputed features in the South China Sea only served to raise tensions and destabilize the region. The statement said that disinviting China from the 2018 RIMPAC is an initial response to Beijing's South China Sea activities. It did not specify what other steps may be taken. Since 2014, China has taken part in RIMPAC, the world's largest international maritime drill, which is held every 2 years in Hawaii. The U.S. and China said last Sunday they have agreed to back away from imposing tough new tariffs on each other's exports, a day after reaching an accord calling for Beijing to buy more American goods to substantially reduce the huge U.S. trade deficit with China.
We're putting the trade war on hold. So right now we have agreed to put the tariffs on hold while we try to execute the framework.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who told Fox News the world's two biggest economic powers have made very meaningful progress and we agreed on a framework to resolve trade issues, he said.
I'm pleased to report that we've made very meaningful progress and we agreed on a framework, which is important to understand. And the framework includes their agreement to substantially reduce the trade deficit by increasing their purchases of goods. We also discussed very important structural issues that they're going to make in their economy to make sure that we have a fair ability to compete there, and also protections about technology, which have been very important to the president.
China's state-run news agency, Xinhua, quoted Vice Premier Liu He, who led Chinese negotiators in trade talks in Washington last week, as saying the two sides reached a consensus. We will not fight a trade war, and we will stop increasing tariffs on each other. Liu said the agreement was a necessity, but he added, at the same time, it must be realized that unfreezing the ice cannot be done in a day. Solving the structural problems of the economic and trade relations between the two countries will take time. U.S. President Donald Trump had threatened to impose new tariffs on $150 billion worth of Chinese imports, and Beijing had responded that it would do the same on American goods. I spoke via Skype to Phil Levy, senior fellow on the global economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs.
It's not the worst outcome we could have had. It's the sort of mediocre outcome that some of us feared. The worst outcome would have been a tariff war. We've avoided that, and for that we should be thankful. This looks like they're opting for some sort of managed trade solution, which I don't think will do much for either country, but it is better than a tariff war.
Why do you think that China has agreed to make any movement whatsoever?
Well, it's not clear that this is a terribly big move on their part, and they avoided a real disruption to an important trade relationship, that there was a serious threat of a substantial raft of tariffs that were headed their way, and they've averted that threat.
So where does either side go from here, if anywhere?
I think that's part of the problem with the solution is, as far as we can tell, this looks like them saying, there, we fixed the problem, whereas the real underlying problems are not fixed. I think the Trump administration will crow about the fact that they've arranged for some additional sales. That wasn't really the issue. It may have been in their mind, but in terms of what's in the national interest, it wasn't.
What is?
I think there were serious concerns about a range of Chinese behavior. I think if you look at how China has handled intellectual property, how it has treated American investors, how it subsidizes some of its industries, and how it, you know, it gives a prominent role to state-owned enterprises, there are fundamental questions about how a state-dominated economy of that size fits into the global trading system, and I don't think we've answered those questions.
Why do you think the Trump administration has handled this the way it has?
I think they started off with two handicaps. First, there's the president's misunderstanding of the global economy, where he believes that bilateral trade deficits are a measure of how well we're doing. And second, there's the approach he's had where he has a lot of discordant voices all sort of empowered and speaking at once within the administration. So that kind of prevented them from thinking strategically, and it led them to feel satisfied about something which really doesn't do that much for the country.
Let me ask you about the ZTE situation. Where does that stand now? Is there any change in that with this Sunday announcement?
We've gotten kind of mixed signals about where that stands. It seems that the president has backed off from his tweeted statement that the Commerce Department should make everything right. On the other hand, we know it's still very important to the Chinese, and they had set it as something of a prerequisite for taking this set of meetings. So that remains to be seen in terms of how that's actually resolved. We also know that Congress has started to take a stand on this issue, which may well sort of constrain administration options.
Where do you think the U.S. should go from here?
I think the U.S. has to make a fundamental choice, which is, does it want to see China integrated into the global trading system, or does it want to somehow isolate China? I would strongly advocate the former, that it should be a push towards integration. If we're going to have that push towards integration, we need to get back to what Bob Zoellick once called sort of a responsible stakeholder role. What are the kind of behaviors that China needs to undertake to fit within the global trading system? And those are the questions that really need to be addressed. From the reports we've had of these talks, what's striking is they are not a new and more advanced approach to negotiating with the Chinese. If anything, it's something of a retrograde approach to dealing with the Chinese. That this has been what China has tried all along, was to offer a few additional purchases and hope that the Americans would be satisfied with that. Previous administrations were not. This administration seems to be.
We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. The U.S. State Department issued a health alert Wednesday for its citizens in China in response to what it said was a recent report of a U.S. government employee in Guangzhou experiencing subtle and vague but abnormal sensations of sound and pressure. The U.S. Embassy in Beijing said the employee was sent back to the United States for evaluation and diagnosed with a mild traumatic brain injury. Wednesday's alert said the U.S. government does not know the cause of the reported symptoms and has not received similar reports in other parts of China, but that it is taking the report seriously. It advised anyone who experiences unusual acute auditory or sensory phenomena accompanied by unusual sounds or piercing noises to not seek out the source, but instead to move to a location where they're not present. During a joint appearance with the Chinese State Councilor and Foreign Minister Yang Wei, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the State Department is working to determine the cause and impact of the incident.
We're concerned about it. It's a serious medical incident. We want to make sure and take care of every one of our officers serving overseas. We've learned about it only recently. We are still trying to identify all the circumstances surrounding it. We've notified China of what took place as best we know it, and they have responded in a way that is exactly the right response. They've honored their commitment under the Vienna Convention to take care of the diplomats that are serving in their country, and we truly appreciate this. They've offered to assist us in investigating how this came to be, and State Councilor Wong and I had a moment to talk about how we can endeavor to figure out what happened here to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again in their country. And so we're working together to resolve it. I look forward to it. I hope we can figure it out. It's very important that each and every one of our officers, wherever they're serving in the world, is protected and taken care of.
State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said the State Department will be sending a medical team to Guangzhou early next week to conduct baseline medical evaluations of all consulate Guangzhou employees who request it. Last year in Cuba, the United States reported that some of its personnel and family members experienced a range of symptoms, often after hearing an unusual sound, but the cause is still unknown. Bloomberg News, citing people familiar with the matter, reports that China's telecom ZTE, slapped with a 7-year ban on buying U.S. components for its products, has lost more than $3 billion after halting major operations. The ban was imposed after U.S. authorities in April determined the company lied about the sale of products with U.S. parts to Iran and North Korea. Tuesday, President Donald Trump was asked how he envisions resolving the ZTE matter now that the Chinese government has intervened and asked him to revisit the ban.
They can pay a big price without necessarily damaging all of these American companies, which they are, because, you know, you're talking about tremendous amounts of money and jobs to American companies. So I envision a very large fine. I envision perhaps new management, new board of directors, very tight security rules. But we caught them doing bad things. We caught them, not anybody else. We caught them doing bad things. And we essentially made it so difficult that it was shut down. By shutting them down, we're hurting a lot of American companies, really good American companies. So what I envision is a very large fine of more than $1 billion, could be $1.3 billion. I envision a new management, a new board, and very, very strict security rules. And I also envision that they will have to buy a big percentage of their parts and equipment from American companies.
Gary Huffbauer, a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, told VOA's Victor Beatty that ZTE's global success made its current plight important to Beijing, and U.S. sanctions can have an adverse impact on individual companies, as has been proven in penalties levied on Russian firms.
That doesn't mean it changes the policy of the government, but it can really hammer individual companies. And ZTE is quite vulnerable for two reasons. One, it gets most of its critical components from U.S. companies like Qualcomm, and it sells a lot to U.S. firms. So on both sides, it's vulnerable. So Trump put up these alternative ideas of penalties as opposed to denying U.S. companies the ability to sell or buy transactions with ZTE. These alternative penalties are much, much more modest and will not hammer ZTE. I see some senators think that that isn't stiff enough, and they're complaining.
So you're talking about the options that he laid out today, a management shakeup or a large fine,
Yes. Is
not a big deal.
You know, it's painful, but it's not a big deal for a company of ZTE's size and flexibility and, you know, their ability. They can find other managers, you know, not easy, but they will find them. And $1.5 billion, well, you know, that's a lot of money to you and me, but it's not critical to ZTE.
Well, ZTE, of course, has effectively been shut down for a period of up to 7 years. Will it reopen then under such guidelines?
Well, if these guidelines go into effect, yes, it will reopen. That will be part of the U.S.-China broader trade talks. Now, as I mentioned, there's a lot of opposition from Congress where that will press Trump to reverse himself yet again. I don't know, but I doubt it. I think Trump has probably decided, President Trump has decided that this, you know, it's just not critical to the U.S. interest to, you know, bankrupt ZTE.
He's using it perhaps as leverage in the broader U.S.-Chinese relationship?
Yeah, he's getting something in return. And what he seems to be getting in return is a cut in auto tariffs. The Chinese auto tariff is quite high at 25%, and I've seen that they might go down to 15%. Plus, probably politically more important, is China will not put on any new tariffs on U.S. agricultural shipments, soybeans, sorghum, corn, et cetera, and in fact might buy some more of those products. So that would be the quid for the quo.
Gary Huffbauer said recent U.S.-China trade talks produced the outline of a pretty good deal that benefits both countries. It will not reduce the trade imbalance very much, but he expects that it will bring Chinese trade practices more in line with global norms. As for intellectual property theft, he said that is a longer-term issue, and a big step would be ending so-called joint ventures and allowing foreigners to own and operate businesses freely in China. The United States is a land of opportunity for many immigrants, but some who come to the United States often face big hurdles. The challenges can be especially great for immigrant women trying to succeed in male-dominated careers in STEM fields for science, technology, engineering, and math. VOA spoke with three Afghan women, all of whom proved that where there is a will, there is usually a way. Zila Nouri went to Silicon Valley to find out what drives them. Freshta Azizi narrates.
From war-weary Afghanistan to a refugee camp in Pakistan, Sophia Mahfouz has an unlikely story to tell. At seven, she moved to London with her family, where she developed an interest in science from her father, an electrical engineer. Today, she's a successful tech entrepreneur in Silicon Valley. Some find it hard to believe how far she's come.
They cannot put together this picture of this girl who is a refugee to being this entrepreneur in Silicon Valley. And so it's interesting the change in impression they get once I tell them that I'm actually Afghan.
She's not alone. Sarah Dakhik took a similar journey from Kabul to San Francisco, where she works as a software engineer for a leading data security firm. She's faced many challenges trying to succeed in the male-dominated cybersecurity field, but she has never met an obstacle she couldn't overcome.
Obviously, whatever you do, you face challenges, otherwise it's not worthwhile, right? For me, as a software engineer, I have had a lot of challenges, obviously, including things that wasn't pleasant for women at workplace. I think the most important thing that I learned from those is that people shouldn't stop you from getting what you want.
Mara Nawabi agrees. She's part of an elite team of engineers at Lockheed Martin's Advanced Technology Center in Palo Alto, California. Besides saving lives with new satellite technology, the former Afghan refugee has won awards for mentoring other women.
One of them was the Silicon Valley Business Journal, Women of Influence, and that was they selected 100 women from Silicon Valley who were doing great work in their companies as well as what they were doing outside of their companies.
All three are actively involved in inspiring other young women and teaching them how to successfully navigate challenging careers. Mahfouz for her work on Tech Women, a project-based leadership program for women. Nawabi for founding a lean-in circle for women in Palo Alto, California. And Dakhik, who uses her spare time teaching young girls how to code.
I am very proud of that because I feel like women needs to be represented more in technology.
All three feel a responsibility to share what they have learned as immigrants and as women. Their overriding belief that neither gender, circumstance, or place of birth determines your path. It's how willing you are to prepare for it. For Gila Nuri, this is Freshta Azizi.
As part of a wave of women's empowerment programs, the government of Pakistan's Punjab province is running a campaign called Women on Wheels, a two-year-old program that trains women to ride motorcycles as a way to raise awareness of gender-based violence and street harassment. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports on the excitement and independence the campaign has brought to its participants.
Proudly perched on their brand new pink motorcycles, these new riders set out to challenge perceptions in Lahore, Pakistan's second biggest city after Karachi. Rider Nagina Wasim could barely contain her joy.
I am so excited because I am riding the bike right now, and this is my first experience. I am riding on the road.
She says her new riding skills will make a big difference for her and other women.
We're becoming the independent and we can do everything which we want. Otherwise, we were dependent on another person.
Pakistani officials say they want to empower women to enter the labor market by helping them get from point A to point B. Recent studies show about 48% of Pakistani women do not hold paying jobs, mainly because of a lack of transport.
We are giving 3,000 bikes. We have trained over 3,500 girls in all of Punjab, and this is going to go on till we reach a target of around 10,000 plus.
Activist Nigat Dad, who praised the initiative, described it as an important step.
We have seen that women who have got their bikes and have got trainings and now they are on the roads and reclaiming these spaces. So it's a big, big win for women today in Punjab especially.
It's not uncommon to see women on motorcycles in Pakistan, but usually they are seated behind a male driver. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Scientists at Rockefeller University in New York discovered that the brains of songbirds use a similar process as humans do when learning to make sounds. As a result, VOA's Deborah Block reported the research could lead to treatments for people with speech impediments.
The tiny brain of this zebra finch may help scientists answer questions on how people form words to talk. Like humans, songbirds learn to vocalize by imitation.
We're able to not only study the mechanisms of how vocal learning works in these songbirds, but translate those findings to humans. And the reason why is because we discovered that songbirds and humans have what we call convergent brain pathways and genes that are specialized in them that you don't find in things like chicken.
Researchers from Rockefeller University in New York are using laser capture microscopy, a method of isolating cells from microscopic regions of tissues and cells, to get an in-depth look at the songbirds' brains. Those images are helping them understand how signals from the birds' brains are similar to the process humans use when learning to talk.
We find stuttering in songbirds. We can induce a Parkinson-like condition in them that causes stuttering. And then we can use that to figure out how to repair and then try to induce that in a brain like of humans to see if we can repair those circuits. We're also trying to figure out ways to engineer brain circuits in a species that doesn't have that ability to see if we can induce it or even enhance it. And if that works, we can actually try to translate that to humans as well.
Jarvis says it will take years before the findings may be used to treat human speech impediments.
I've had this hypothesis for the last 10 years of how to engineer these brain circuits and predict what kind of genes we would find that are specialized in the brain of humans and songbirds. It took us, let's say, 5 to 7 years to actually identify those genes. And I think it's going to take us another 5 to 7 years to actually figure out how to manipulate them.
Songbirds could provide a window to the origins of speech disorders caused by autism, strokes, and Parkinson's disease. Deborah Block, VOA News.
While hackers steal credit card numbers online, other crooks do it directly from the card, at the point where a consumer exchanges the data with a cash or banking machine. The U.S. Secret Service says those crooks, called skimmers, steal more than $1 billion a year. A group of students at the University of Florida is developing a device that may put a stop to this type of crime. We start with details from VOA's George Futich.
Advanced credit cards have electronic chips, which are difficult to crack. But many of them also have magnetic strips, so they can be used on older card readers, usually in small stores and gas pumps. And that's where they get compromised.
Credit cards are read using something called a card reader or a read head. At any given time, only one read head should be present in a card slot.
Crooks simply attach their own card readers onto the existing ones, and when a customer inserts the credit card, the extra reader retrieves all the information needed to create a perfect copy. This type of crime is widespread, especially in large cities such as New York, where only 4 detectives are trained to spot extra readers attached to ATMs. Now, their task may become easier with a device called the Skim Reaper, invented by a group of students at the University of Florida, led by Professor Patrick Trainer.
We're glad to be able to produce something that will curb the tide.
The device consists of an electronic card, about twice as long as the regular credit card, attached to a box with a digital display. When inserted in the ATM slot, the digital display immediately reveals the presence of an extra card reader.
So impressed with their technology and their wit on how to come up with this machine to detect skimming devices.
The parts for the card reader detector cost about $50, but its inventors say they are trying to make it cheaper and smaller so that even untrained law enforcement officers can use it on a daily basis. George Putich, VOA News.
Before the decision was made to halt the meeting between President Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, South Korean President Moon Jae-in met in the day Monday with U.S. President Donald Trump in preparation for that summit. The two leaders spoke by telephone Sunday for about 20 minutes. The conversation took place after the North threatened to cancel the planned meeting over joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises and demands for its unilateral nuclear disarmament. Robert Manning is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington. He told VOA's Victor Beatty that Pyongyang's threat underscores the mutual deep distrust that lingers despite this year's apparent thaw.
Part of it is kind of pre-negotiating posturing to try to gain leverage. I think the North Koreans are trying to get an upper hand on President Moon's administration. That's not clear to me why they suddenly made this demand. It may be that there were some references in South Korea about defectors, and this is sort of their way of trying to establish some sort of equivalence.
Could it possibly be to divide South Korean public opinion?
I think you already have a divided public opinion in South Korea. You have a leftist government that sees North Korea more as a partner than a threat, and you have a lot of conservatives in North Korea who are very hostile to North Korea. And so the North Koreans are playing into that. For President Moon, he's got to demonstrate results. Since the summit, his popularity has gone pretty much straight up. But if there's no follow-through, if this process doesn't start producing results, it will slip back the other way.
Is there any daylight between the South Korean and U.S. positions?
Yes, I think you saw that the South Koreans were concerned about the question of B-52s involved in the exercise. I think that when there was a summit between Moon and Kim Jong-un, and they were told by the North Koreans that they understood that the U.S. and South Korea had to do exercises. But I think there was some reference at that point to hoping that there would not be strategic weapons involved. As you know, B-52s are nuclear capable. That may have been one reason why the North Koreans reacted. They obviously knew that there were exercises planned. They happen every year. There's not particularly unusual. I think the North Koreans are trying to play a game here where they've taken a number of steps, most of which didn't really cost them anything. They claim to have completed their nuclear and testing program, so suspending missile and nuclear tests was not really a sacrifice. And in terms of the nuclear test site they're destroying, there's a lot of evidence that suggests if they would have done one more test, the whole thing would have caved in.
North Korea Sunday stressed the importance of its dismantling of the Punggye-ri nuclear test site, calling it a very meaningful and significant measure undertaken voluntarily to achieve the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang announced its intention to take down the site in the presence of international journalists between Wednesday and Friday. Something strange is happening with a now-banned chemical that eats away at the Earth's protective ozone layer. Scientists say there's more of it, not less, going into the atmosphere, and they don't know where it's coming from. When a hole in the ozone formed over Antarctica, countries around the world in 1987 agreed to phase out several types of ozone-depleting chemicals called chlorofluorocarbons. Production of these CFCs was banned, emissions fell, and the hole slowly shrank. But starting in 2013, emissions of the second most common kind started rising, according to a study in Wednesday's journal Nature. The chemical called CFC-11, also known as Freon, was used for making foam, degreasing stains, and for refrigeration. I spoke with the author of the report, Steve Munska, a research scientist at the U.S. government's National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Boulder, Colorado.
CFC-11 concentrations are decreasing in the atmosphere, and they continue to decrease, just not as fast as they had been. What has increased are emissions, and we derive rates of global emissions based on the concentration measurements we make in the atmosphere.
CFC, as I was growing up, was a good thing. This is what people used in air conditioning and refrigeration and all kinds of other products and things like that.
Yes, CFCs were wonder chemicals. They replaced flammable refrigerants and things like that, or toxic refrigerants, so that you didn't have any longer a toxic chemical in your kitchen. But unfortunately, CFCs get mixed and lofted in the atmosphere up into the upper atmosphere or stratosphere, where they get photolyzed, in other words, blown apart by high-energy UV radiation, and the products of that photolysis, chlorine and bromine atoms, react with ozone. And that ozone in the stratosphere is important because it filters damaging high-energy ultraviolet radiation from reaching the Earth's surface.
So, what has caused this change that you have noticed? But where is it coming from?
We can look at our measurements, and they seem to tell us, they point to this increased emission apparently coming from the region of Eastern Asia.
You can't be any more specific than that?
The closest site we make measurements at to Eastern Asia is Hawaii, which is quite a ways away. So with uncertainty in our understanding of how the winds blow and wind direction from Asia to Hawaii kind of prevents us from further focusing in on where that emission actually is. But, you know, there are measurements of these chemicals made in Eastern Asia, and ultimately the next step I hope that those folks will take, the scientists there, is to study their measurements and use them to help pinpoint this source.
What would contribute to this kind of a finding? What kind of event, what kind of manufacturing, whatever it might be, what could contribute to that?
A couple things to consider. There's lots of CFC-11 contained in foams currently. And if those products or foams were being degraded and recycled or ground up at an increased rate at a certain location, that would lead to increased emissions. The other thing is that there's a lot of chemical manufacturing around the world, the chlorination and fluorination of methanes to produce things we use every day, things like polyvinyl chloride or PVC tubing, things like Teflon, other chemicals like that. And that process of fluorinating and chlorinating methane could produce CFC-11. So maybe it's some inadvertent production related to that.
How much danger is this to the world's population?
You know, I think we're fortunate that our measurement capabilities and the state of the global atmospheric monitoring system is pretty good, so that we've been able to detect this emission increase before it's really become a serious problem. So this increased emission isn't really going to cause a substantial amount of ozone depletion. The problem would be if it were to continue into the future. I liken it to the check engine light going on in my car. Something's going on, and if we want to keep moving down the path that we hope to move on, we might stop and check under the hood here before the situation gets worse.
Stay with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. Mourners packed a mosque in Stafford, Texas, about 59 kilometers away from the mass school shooting Friday that killed 10 people. One of the victims was a Pakistani exchange student who wanted to learn about the American culture and share her own. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reported from her funeral.
This is more than an afternoon prayer. It is a last goodbye to 17-year-old foreign exchange student Sabika Sheikh.
We did not have children. She was the first one who called us mom and dad. She was literally like a daughter to us.
Uzma Parveen was Sabika's first host mother in the United States. This photo from Sabika's Instagram feed shows a teenager excited about life in the United States. Parveen says Sabika had big dreams.
She wanted to be everyone, and the only regret that she wanted to be famous. Not like that. I don't want to see her picture on the TV like that. I don't want to see that she was one of the victims.
Attending this funeral is Jerry Manlove, the coordinator of the exchange program. She remembers texting Sabika the day of the shooting and never getting a response.
She and two other students and a teacher hid in the classroom. They hid. They found a closet, but the boy found them.
If anybody listens to me, I have only one appeal. Please do something. No children should be taken away from parents. It hurts. Believe me, it hurts. One metal detector could have saved her. Just one.
Friends say Sabika was looking forward to going home in a few weeks at the end of Ramadan. Her second host family attended and spoke at the funeral.
When she started Ramadan and started fasting, my family did that with her because we did things together.
She was the most beautiful, loving person I've ever met.
The families and friends touched by Sabika say knowing her has changed their lives permanently. For that, they are thankful to her parents in Pakistan.
Thank you for sharing such a wonderful daughter with us, with me and Rashid. Thank you so much. We are with you in your grief. We are not going to be the same people anymore.
They say Sabika may be gone, but her love will always be with them. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Stafford, Texas.
Over the centuries, Tibetan monks have created mandalas, fanciful images of the universe with complex iconography. Losang Samten is one of them. The American scholar and artist is best known for creating mandalas in colored sand for the public and sharing messages of healing and peace. VOA's June So caught up with him in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Molly McKitterick narrates.
When I was a teenager, age of 17, I have a privilege to enter to the Hiswanis Dalai Lama's monastery in India. I have been studying a sand mandala ever since then, so it's a long time.
Painstakingly layering grains of colored sand, Losang Samten is creating the mandala of compassion, or unconditional love, over a week in the gallery of the Philadelphia Folklore Project.
What I'm doing now in the Philadelphia Folklore Project is the center of the mandala. But if let's say we will decide to do a whole mandala of compassion, at least it may going to take us 3 weeks to complete.
When Samten created a sand mandala at the American Museum of History in New York in 1988, it was the first time the ancient ritual art was seen outside of monasteries. Since then, Samten has made sand mandalas in museums, galleries, and universities across the U.S. and many parts of the world.
These are uniquely designed for many years. So passing through artist to another artist to another artist, another artist, another artist. So the color has a meaning, shape have a different meanings. So I have a not my design. It didn't came out of my own idea.
Samten was born in Tibet. When he was a young boy, his family escaped to Nepal, fleeing Chinese communist control of his country. They lived in a refugee camp for years.
The winter of 1959, crossed the Mount Everest. It took us to 2 months to cross. You cannot travel during the day. And so scared. And not enough food, not enough clothes. I was age of five. I seen him, unbelievable dead bodies, people dying without food. I become a monk age of 11, and when I was in school, refugee school.
Samten left monastic life in 1995 and became the spiritual director at the Tibetan Buddhist Center of Philadelphia. He says the patience of the creative process can lead observers to find calm determination within themselves.
When I'm doing this mandala at the universities and in the schools, many kids came to me. When I saw Yung doing a sand mandala, that helped me so much to finish my education. Patience. Well, I have a lot of stories.
When a sand mandala creation is completed, a dismantling ceremony follows. Samten often invites children to participate in the ceremony.
Dismantle have many different reasons. One thing is a dismantle is a beauty, whatever we see as a beauty on the earth, never be as a last as a beauty. And impermanent, comes and goes.
I think it's powerful to see something so beautiful created and then taken apart and to be done in a community with a group of people of different ages. I just think it's an important type of practice.
For producer June So, I'm Molly McKitterick, VOA News, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
A sick toddler is thriving thanks to his father's kidney. VOA Steve Barragona said he's also doing well thanks to practice surgery using 3D printed organs.
3-year-old Dexter Clark was born with bad kidneys. His father, Brendan, says the boy was constantly sick.
When he was 1 year old, we had to have a procedure to give him a gastrostomy so he could be fed through a tube because he threw up so much.
A kidney transplant would change Dexter's life. His father's matched, but Brendan's kidney was bigger than average, which would complicate surgery. So doctors at Guy's and St. Thomas NHS Foundation Trust 3D printed copies of Brendan's and Dexter's organs. Practicing on the replica organs allows doctors to spot potential problems before the actual operation begins, says transplant surgeon Nikos Kasaris.
The components are flexible, so you can manipulate them to simulate the steps of the operation as well.
Technology company Stratasys developed the 3D organ printer. These practice organs can help cut the cost of healthcare, says company vice president Phil Reeves.
If we can take an hour or 2 hours off a procedure, if we can reduce the amount of time in that theater, reduce the amount of recovery time, the amount of beds being taken up, all of that compounded really drives the economic argument for where 3D printing helps the health service.
What's inside?
Daddy's kidney.
Yeah.
And helps a 3-year-old boy and his family lead a normal life. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Interstellar space is mostly vacuum, so there is no medium that can carry sound. In other words, space is totally silent. However, astronomers have often associated the movement of heavenly bodies with music. With the help of modern technology, VOA's George Pudich said one astronomer had actually turned the signals from space into music.
Documentary and feature film producers often give space a sinister-sounding electronic background. But University of Massachusetts astronomy research professor Mark Heyer says the universe, or more precisely our galaxy, the Milky Way, sounds more like this.
An idea that I had for a long time, and only recently has some of the technology came about that somebody like me could access that and turn my algorithm, actually, which turns the velocities into notes, but then I want to be able to play that back, and that technology that has been out recently afforded me the path to do that.
The visible light coming from distant worlds carries a lot of information that can be analyzed with a spectroscope. Heyer developed a computer program or algorithm to convert the movement of large clouds of atoms and molecules of different elements and compounds into music.
I take the spectrum and I essentially mathematically resample that to a musical scale, and that gives that spectrum, which is inherently atonal, it gives a tonality. And that's what really is a key step to make it sound nice.
Heyer randomly assigned different musical instruments to different gases, forming a combo consisting of a saxophone, a piano, an upright bass, and some percussion woodblocks. For instance, a certain atomic gas, which fills much of the space between the stars, is represented by the upright bass.
So it gives you that driving pulse, I think, that sort of drives the music forward. And the wood blocks sort of do that as well.
After some experimenting, Heyer decided to use the pentatonic minor blues scale.
I've been experimenting with the algorithm, and I had major scales and simple minor scales. But when I first, played, a little segment of just one of the instruments, it sounded like that could be a very nice blues or jazzy sound to it. And so then I recrafted the algorithm so it could transform the data into a musical blues scale.
Heyer says he was surprised when he realized for the first time that the rotation of our galaxy contains a rhythm, and the funky blues seemed to fit perfectly. George Pudich, VOA News.
VOA Asia continues. The Philippines has expressed serious concerns over the presence of Chinese strategic bombers in the contested South China Sea. A spokesman for President Rodrigo Duterte said appropriate diplomatic action has been taken. Chinese state-run media had said that the People's Liberation Army Air Force conducted takeoff and landing training with the H-6K bomber, although it did not specify where in the region that took place. However, an analysis by the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies suggested it was Woody Island in the Paracels, also claimed by Vietnam and Taiwan. A U.S. defense spokesman said China's continued militarization of disputed features of the South China Sea only served to raise tensions and destabilize the region. University of New South Wales professor emeritus Carl Thayer told VOA's Victor Beatty this latest development represents another in a line of Chinese military activities that have included fleet actions, including China's latest aircraft carrier and military activities around Taiwan.
These kind of simulated sea strikes occur as part of naval exercises, so that's not new, but landing them on Woody Island where the airstrip has been extended is new and extends the strike range to include a vast circle around Southeast Asia and the South China Sea.
According to China, it said the pilot of an H-6K bomber conducted assault training on a designated sea target and then carried out takeoffs and landings at an airport in the area, describing the exercise as preparation for, quote, the West Pacific and the battle for the South China Sea. What do you make of that?
Well, we often give bellicose rhetoric from China as a way of, there's an old expression, and I've actually heard a Chinese general say it at a conference, you do one, we do one and a half, you do two, we do two and a half. It's that constant assertion of Chinese sovereignty, the firm resolve of China to stand its ground, that in a sense we're just talking of strike activities. The United States maintains a continuous bomber patrol presence in the region that has got very little publicity, even though Freedom of Navigation has got much higher ones. You know, say that China flying bombers around the east coast of Taiwan have sort of upped the ante a bit in response to what they say is congressional action on slightly raising ties with Taiwan. It's bellicose. It demonstrates, though, that all we have from the White House, not a reaction necessarily to the bombers, but to the jammers and the missiles, was that there will be near and long-term consequences, and these have not yet been identified.
A Philippine opposition lawmaker condemned China's quote-unquote militarization of the South China Sea, while another congressman said the issue has now become one of global concern, suggesting that the country is now within striking distance of nuclear-capable bombers.
Well, I think we're seeing within the Defense Department public statements bubbling to the surface, indicating strong concerns. And the U.S. has, within the last several months, sent two aircraft carrier groups to visit the Philippines, conducted major land exercises this year, which had amphibious components. So we're still seeing a puzzle that hasn't been completely put together to know how firmly the Philippines is going to support an alliance and oppose China or continue to roll over, and how much China is going to I see it as an opportunistic push at the moment to advance just incrementally.
He said this development could drive the Philippines closer to the United States, which periodically conducts freedom of navigation and aircraft missions in the region. Drivers can choose from several GPS apps that can alert them to accidents or slow traffic so they can avoid them. However, bike riders who travel the same roadways as cars are on their own. VOA's Faith Lapidus told us of an English university student who designed an app to help cyclists report dangerous hotspots to other cyclists and local governments.
It's called Flare, and it looks like an ordinary light you clip onto your handlebars. But Jake Thompson, a product design student at the University of Sussex, says the three buttons on its surface let cyclists report problems they encounter on roads the moment they see them. Each click of a button sends the location of that problem to a phone app. After their ride, cyclists confirm their flares on the app and add comments. Their reports can be loaded onto a map. Thompson says that data can show local governments where to target funds for road repairs to give everyone a smoother ride. Thompson has been contacted by local authorities in California and Australia about setting up pilot schemes there for what he calls the first app-integrated smart bicycle light. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Thank you for giving us your time and attention for VOA Asia Weekend. Be sure to listen again next weekend and check out more stories at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.